KALW.
From KALW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents. Context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
I live in San Carlos.
Berkeley.
Potrero Hill.
Vernal Heights.
Sharp Park.
Park Pacifica.
Vivo in Union City.
Coming up, we head inside the Museum of Capitalism in Oakland.
I feel conflicted about capitalism. I feel in awe of it. Sometimes I feel terrified.
Then we get to San Francisco the old-fashioned way, by ferry.
Somebody said to me once, it's the only commute that you wish it were longer.
And we hear from Oakland-based singer-songwriter Quinn DeVoe about his retro sound.
You know how you have that second stomach for dessert? You know, it's really a separate thing when you're moving to good soul music.
We're finding our groove today on Cross Currents. Stay with us. The U.S. economy doesn't look too shabby right now. The job numbers are through the roof. The stock market is hitting record highs. Just ask President Trump.
We have a growth rate, a GDP, which has been much higher than, as you know, anybody anticipated, except maybe us. But then it's going to go higher, too. We're doing a job.
Despite this, the gap between the rich and the poor keeps getting wider. One-fifth of Oakland residents live below the poverty line. Still, blaming an entire economic system like capitalism can feel vague and ineffective. But there's one place in Oakland where people are encouraged to imagine an alternative post-capitalist reality. KALW's Holly J. McDeed takes us there.
Pretend capitalism is over. We don't know how or why or what comes next. But it's no longer late stage. It's terminal. That's the future the Museum of Capitalism wants you to imagine, like science fiction. So pretend you're in the future at a history museum, where we remember what it was like under capitalism, or is like. Anyway, the museum in Oakland's Jack London Square is a collection of curated artifacts, or conceptual art pieces. Timothy Firstnow is cranking away at a minimum wage machine.
When you crank the handle, here, I'll give it a crank. It actually spits out pennies at the rate of minimum wage.
In Oakland, that's $12.86 per hour.
So if I were to crank this handle for an hour, I would get $12.86.
Wow. Firstnow is one of the museum's curators. Andrea Steves is the other. Together, they create and curate art under the name Fictalis.
The Museum of Capitalism is a museum that looks back on capitalism and remembers capitalism as a historical phenomenon.
This pop-up museum is located in a giant warehouse overlooking the Oakland waterfront. People outside are kayaking and sipping gourmet coffee while the train whistles by. The exhibits in this museum reflect some of the basic tenets of capitalism, like trading labor for wages and allowing the free market to determine the value of goods and services. The museum also highlights some practices that Karl Marx didn't see coming, like trading internal organs for cash. That brings us to the next display. Glass kidneys on a pedestal.
I think it's a sort of visual representation of a larger phenomenon of the way that the body can be bought and sold. And I think the presentation...
First now grimaces in horror, like he's scared the way he's speaking is too laissez-faire and he needs to self-regulate. Steves glances at him. I should mention they're not just artistic partners. They're also married.
Don't answer things if you don't feel like you have a good answer for it. I mean, right?
In competitive markets, marriage can lead to higher median family incomes. United by capital and history, these bonds can also produce interactions strangers like myself don't always understand. This artistic duo is both delightful and awkward.
I thought it sounded okay. When you emailed, he hates radio.
Oh,
every time we've had a radio interview, he gets really angry about it.
I promise I will not be angry.
He sent me an all caps email that said never again. So
the fortunate among us don't have to give up a kidney to survive late stage capitalism. I'm a journalist, paid to ask strangers questions. In return, the people I interview get publicity. But there's something about our interaction, or transaction, that feels strange. Like Fictalis is all too aware of their supply and my demands.
So this is a piece by Jennifer Dalton that's called Reckoning. And visitors to the gallery are invited to fill out these forms that correspond with either a sort of gesture of surplus or debt.
Cool. Well, how does this fit in with the theme of capitalism?
I don't want to answer that. Sorry.
Okay.
I don't know.
First Now is determined not to sell me any commodity of value.
I can try and answer a non-answer.
Do a non-answer.
Yeah. They don't necessarily say something specific about capitalism.
That's when I finally get it. The artwork isn't telling people how to feel. This is not an anti-capitalist museum. No explicit agenda, no proposed solutions. Just a starting point for visitors to reflect.
So I think it's difficult to find distance from something like capitalism when you feel like you're in it. You know, there's a sort of joke about the fish in the water, and the one fish says, "How's the water?" And the other fish says, "What water?" Right?
Even First Now is still figuring out how he feels about capitalism from inside the fishbowl.
This is maybe a good place where a one-word answer would be good, but I have to think hard about what the one word would be.
Long pauses like First Now's here aren't so good for radio, but it is kind of the point of the museum, to pause and reflect.
Maybe I feel conflicted about capitalism. I feel curious about it. I feel in awe of it sometimes. I feel terrified other times.
He says, as a way of producing and distributing resources, capitalism is just one economic solution.
It's a solution that doesn't work for everyone and doesn't work with everything, and it doesn't seem like it's possible for it to work forever.
The thing is, as artists and curators, Fictalis is actually pretty good at accumulating capital. They got a big grant to launch this museum and partnered with the Jack London Improvement District to find a space here by the waterfront and train station.
That's kind of made a lot of people scratch their heads. Like, you're an economic development, sort of business improvement entity. Why are you hosting a museum of capitalism?
Savlon Hauser is the executive director of the Jack London Improvement District.
We just love seeing vacant spaces activated and bringing new people to the district who wouldn't ordinarily visit.
The Museum of Capitalism occupies a warehouse that was renovated to house an upscale food hall. But the forces of the market intervened and the plan collapsed during the 2008 global economic crisis. Until recently, it sat empty. There's lots of empty space in Jack London Square.
We want to reflect the community's needs, but also find a home for uses that are homeless, like this museum.
Homeless, that's a funny word to use in Oakland in 2017. There's a homeless encampment just a few blocks away. Hauser says neighbors here are keenly aware of this.
And we're all feeling a little under-resourced and powerless to do any major change.
Yeah. The story of the Jack London District is economics 101. Several decades ago, developers swooped into this former industrial neighborhood to turn it into a tourist destination. But they overestimated the demand, and many of the warehouses are still empty. In a capitalist economic system, people buy and rent property with capital. Also under capitalism, not everyone has enough.
The fact that this museum deals with the content of capitalism is fascinating for us as a changing neighborhood, but also a really relevant conversation to make active in Oakland right now. So we're not afraid of the challenging content.
Back inside, Steve's and First Now take me to a display of clay heads dangling above a bed of dirt and plants.
I just watered it this morning. It's perking up. I know.
It's like, it looks so sad.
It takes a while to. But that one's flowering. This is an amazing moment.
It is an amazing moment.
The dangling clay heads represent Thomas Midgley Jr., a chemical engineer who developed a new formula for gasoline. His inventions made internal combustion engines work better by adding lead, which poisons the air and our bodies. This weekend, visitors are invited to return the favor by smashing Midgley's head in.
And when smashed, the head containers will disperse seeds that can help remediate the climate change that Midgley's inventions and many other people's have created.
Soon after the clay heads are smashed, the Museum of Capitalism will shut its doors. But outside, amid the fancy restaurants, yacht clubs, a bowling alley, just down the block from the homeless encampments and extreme poverty, it's a capitalist theme park. Does that mean it's time for the revolution to begin? Nah, it's less dramatic. Coffee roasters are moving into the warehouse space that once held art. Worry not. Extreme wealth, profit motives, competition, and desperation will remain on display in every city in America long after the Museum of Capitalism is gone. But you may have to squint. Fish don't notice the water when they're swimming in it. In Oakland, I'm Holly J. McDeed for Cross Currents.
You can visit the Museum of Capitalism yourself. It's on display until this Sunday in Oakland's Jack London waterfront. For more information, go to KALW.org and click Cross Currents. This is Cross Currents. I'm Hannah Baba. For the next story, we're staying near Jack London Square, where commuters flock each morning to get to San Francisco by boat. They used to do it a lot more. Back before the Bay Bridge was completed in 1936, ferries carried nearly 50 million passengers a year. How does one of the Bay Area's most old-fashioned forms of transportation handle a modern commuter's demands? Reporter Julie Kane got on board to find out.
Welcome aboard the Alameda-Oakland Ferry Service. Please pay close attention to
It's a calm Tuesday afternoon on the docks of San Francisco's Ferry Building. A group of second graders giggle and jostle each other, excited to get on board the ferry to Alameda. Crew members greet passengers and sell tickets. On the back of the boat, a couple of tourists take pictures of seagulls and the skyline. Regular commuters stop at the snack bar before settling in for the 20-minute ride. Jack Dibas lives in Alameda and works in San Francisco. He's been commuting on the ferry for 15 years.
It's quite a bit more civilized than any other mode of transportation, I think. You're not packed in like sardines. You could actually open your laptop and work. You can talk to people, you can hear people, and there's a full bar.
That's right, a full bar. For regular riders like Dibas, getting to and from work on the ferry can be a very social scene. People know each other, they have certain places they like to sit, and they're friendly with the captain and crew.
People take ownership of the ferries in a way that I don't think they do on other public transit. It's a very much of a community thing.
That's Ernest Sanchez. He oversees ferry service between San Francisco and the East Bay for WETA.
Water Emergency Transportation Authority.
Most mornings, the scene on the bay is far from an emergency. So most of the time, Sanchez can focus on other things, like planning new ferry routes. But WETA's biggest job is to make sure boats are available in case a terrorist attack or major earthquake takes out BART and the bridges.
It could take several weeks, months, who knows, before we could be back into a situation where business is operating as normal. And during that time, we'd need to move supplies, we need to move people, we need to move equipment and other things necessary to bring us back into a state of operation.
It was just such an emergency that really jump-started the region's ferry service. Ridership dropped significantly after the Bay Bridge opened in 1936, and ferries pretty much died out until 1970, when the Golden Gate Ferry started service from Marin. When the Vallejo Ferry opened in 1986, its main job was to take people to Marine World, which had just relocated from Southern California.
So the Oakland A's take.
But then, in 1989, damage from the Loma Prieta earthquake closed down the Bay Bridge for almost a month. During that time, ferries were one of the most direct ways to get into San Francisco. Again, transportation planner Tony Brizzoni.
That actually got things started, got the Alameda service started, the Oakland service. It pumped up the Vallejo service.
And 1.5 million people now ride those ferries every year. It's not much compared to the 350,000 people who ride BART every day. Still, ferries are one of the region's more financially stable transit services. Ticket sales pay for about half of what the ferries cost to operate. Only BART and Caltrain have a better record.
All ashore gateway, next stop will be Oakland.
Even so, the ferry's busiest days are the ones when BART or the bridges are closed. And with the region's population expected to increase by about 2 million people in the next 20 years, planners are starting to think about the ferry's role in getting those people around. Transportation planner Tony Brizzoni says that raises some longer-term questions.
What are the trade-offs of building eventually a new BART tube or providing service, more service on buses or more service on ferries? But if you're going to provide the service on ferries, you need to make sure that people actually take it and they can get to it.
Brizzoni says it all comes down to land use and development.
So you have to look at a ferry terminal the same way you look at a train station. It has to have, it's best to have a lot of people living around it so that they don't have to drive to it and that it's an easy walk to them. And then, but on top of that, like a train station, it needs to have really good connecting bus service into it.
In San Francisco, that's easy. It's a short walk from Muni and BART to ferry terminals. But the situation in the East Bay is complicated. Again, WETA's Ernest Sanchez.
Especially recent economic problems have seriously affected public transit. At one point, we had a good bus service to our terminals, and that is, you know, has changed.
Getting more people to ferries is a long-term challenge, but once they're there, the ferries do have one big advantage over other modes of transit. They're fun to ride. Sanchez says that enjoyment is so big a factor that when older boats were replaced with faster vessels, passengers started to complain.
Because the commute time now was like 19 minutes from Alameda rather than 27 or 28. And from Oakland, it was only 20-something minutes. And so people were concerned that they didn't have enough time to talk with their friends and hang out, or for that matter to have the additional cocktail because we do serve liquor on board. So it's kind of interesting. In the old days, when you read about the ferries back in the heyday of ferries, I mean, that was taking an hour plus to go, and so they had card games and weddings and feasts and all sorts of things.
Regular commuter Noelle Lawrence says she understands the appeal.
Somebody said to me once, it's the only commute that you wish it were longer.
Docking at the Port of Oakland, this is Julie Kane for Cross Currents.
This is Cross Currents. I'm Hena Baba. Oakland-based singer-songwriter Quinn DeVoe is one part city, one part country.
I'm packing up.
When he plays with his band, the Blue Beat Review, he taps into Ray Charles and plays the savvy band leader, burning his way through tune after tune and keeping his audience dancing into the late night. When he plays solo, he's more like a Muddy Waters. Listening to his recordings, you can almost see him rocking on his porch, plucking away at his guitar and telling stories to the passing tumbleweeds. But with or without a band, DuVoe's music always captures an ease, a joy, and a purity that ties it all together. A few years back, he sat down for an edition of Bay Area Beats.
Half of the time, the music chooses you. It's just like kids, you know, they're all just kids. And you're birthing them and you're trying to help them grow, you know. I don't have any kids, but I imagine it's similar to raising kids, just in terms of, in some ways you're leading, in some ways you're following, you know. So it's just really kind of, you know, being loose enough to flow with it. The times when I do go after a certain sound, yeah, it just depends on what it is. It, you know, it could be a modern sound or an old sound, you know, or just some beat that I feel like just really needs to be revisited.
Well, my baby, coming home tomorrow. Ain't that good news? Lord, ain't that new.
When I write the stuff for the Blue Beat Review, it tends to be a bit more, you know, about love and about, you know, loss of love and things like that, you know, just because that's the sort of genre, you know. I mean, what I would really like to do and you know, what I am doing is sort of moving away from that into, you know, using the same genre, but moving into topics like life or death or just stories or, you know, things that are atypical of that genre. You know, for now, you know, we're pretty much just sticking with love.
A party at the station. Ain't that good news? Lord, ain't that
new. I think there's definitely a trend towards old time music, you know, with Sharon Jones and like Fits and the Tantrums and things. But I think that there's a hole in pop music right now. I think, you know, there's a hole in the soul.
Come and go.
Come and go, child.
Come and go.
Come and go.
Come and go.
Where I'm bound.
Come and go.
Come on, darling.
Come and go.
Come and go.
Come and go.
Lord, where I'm bound. Come and go.
Because I'm not so much into hip hop and sort of neo soul. I mean, you know, there's some, I love Erykah Badu, I love D'Angelo and different things, but the root of that, the root of like, you know, these amazing, you know, soul love songs is gospel. There's something about gospel music because the people who are singing that music, you know, they're singing about life and death, you know, which is deeper than love. The thing that those guys were going for was just this deep thing. It's at the center of the earth, man. You know, I don't know exactly what it is, but that's the thing that I want, really. I'm just keep trying to dig and get to it. I sort of have this idea of when I get older, I don't want to dance around, you know, like Mick Jagger. So I just see myself, you know, just traveling around to festivals, playing guitar. I got my dog in the truck and, you know, I just toss the guitar in the back and, you know, we're just, you know, barreling through the country. You know, I show up and, you know, entertain the folks with me and my guitar and then be on my way.
Can't hang around your mother.
That was singer-songwriter Quinn DeVoe in a piece produced by Jamie Katsoufis. Catch him performing tomorrow evening at the New Parish in Oakland. And more information is at klw.org. Click Cross Currents.
Till she can't hardly stand. Every dime or penny, had to walk a mile to raise your hand.
And that's all for today's show. Our team includes Anjali Bhatt, Janae Darden, Nina Gensler-Debs, Gabe Graben, Jesse Rhodes, Judy Silber, Stephen Short, and Andrew Stelzer. Our line producer is Hannah Kingsley Ma. The engineer is James Rollins. Our managing editor is Jen Chien. Our news director is Ben Trefney. Our theme music is by the John Santos Quintet. It's Throwback Thursday when we go back to the Summer of Love in 1967. So today's music is by The Grateful Dead, a name that Jerry Garcia, the band's founder, said he happened to see in a dictionary. It refers to a folktale about a wanderer who aids in a poor man's burial. The Grateful Dead from San Francisco were noted for long sets, and many of their shows were free. You just had to ask around at Golden Gate Park or check the schedule at the Matrix Club. For Cross Currents, I'm Hannah Baba.
And my tunes were played on the harp unstrung. Would you hear my voice come through the music? Would you hold it near as it were your own? It's a hand-me-down. The thoughts are broken. Perhaps they're better left unsung.